Welcome everyone to another podcast here on Good Areas. This is the Wagon Wheel, the podcast where we answer your questions. If you're watching live on YouTube, you already know the drill. You already understand the drill. You have shares in the drill. I don't understand. But you can put in a super chat at any time if you would like to. If you're not live on YouTube and you know, we do these at random times, so the chances are that you will not always be available. The best ways to support us on Patreon. Patreon is actually, even through our advertising and everything else, Patreon is like the most consistent way of supporting the network, if you're able to do that. And, you know, a big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. And then there's a certain tier at which you can ask questions on the Wagon Wheel podcast, which Neil has. And Neil has said, so flat wickets are the way to go forward for England to maximise their chance of winning this series then. I don't know. If India had taken their catches, wouldn't they have just won this test anyway? I think we overreact a little bit to one-off things. There's been a lot of talk about how flat pitches help England in baseball, but it's also helped them on some pretty extreme surfaces as well. I don't think they have much of a choice. I think and I've been saying this for a long time, I think the vast majority of the pitches are going to be flat for long periods of time in this series. And I thought when the pitch was flat, England also looked kind of bereft of ideas, which is a normal thing. You know, recent times we've seen, three teams, Australia in the second innings at Lord's, England and India look pretty bereft on some of these wickets. They're not as used to bowling on them because that doesn't happen as much anyway. Whereas you watch the West Indies game and you're just like, wow, you know, how Australia weren't bowled out for 85 there. I never understand how they got to 120 for three. They were some of the luckiest batting I've ever seen. But the point being is the bowlers are used to bowling on that. And you saw, again, when the Australians saw the ball, everyone's kind of used to bowling on those conditions that are helpful. And it wasn't that long ago that you would see the opposite happening in Test cricket where, you know, teams are really good at bowling on flat pitches and, you know, even if they didn't get many wickets. And then they get overly excited when they get a spicy wicket. But yeah, not sure 100% agree with that one, Neil, but I understand why you're asking. Lemon says, would Ben Ducker be seen as the best batter in the world if he's 6'5"? Also, is your book out in Australia? I haven't received my copy yet. I don't know what's going on with the Australian. To be honest, I've kind of paid, so many people from India have asked about it, that I've spent almost all my time worried about that. I've had a couple of people from Australia ask, let me just have a look, Australia. So the hardcover is out in India now, and I believe the soft cover is out next week, but I've heard those dates quite a bit. So until I actually see it, I don't know if I would believe that. In Australia, let's have a look. I think it says it's out of stock. It just comes to the Australian one. I can't look it up, can I? My memory is that it's going to be July. No one from Bloomsbury Australia has ever contacted me or got in touch, so I thought during the World Test Championship they might. The Ashes is coming out this year, so I think coming into the Ashes, I'll probably hear more of them. The overarching idea, I would assume, is to get it out before Father's Day because, you know, the two big events in Australian cricket books and Australian sports books in general are Father's Day and Christmas. So they'll probably make sure it's available before Father's Day, and then we'll go from there. But, yeah, I mean, it's important to know that, like, I would have to contact all these companies directly, and in some cases I have. And like, you know, it's not always easy. I only have contacts with Bloomsbury in the UK, right? Like that's who I signed my deal with. Connor says, there's a lot of focus on overloading Bumrah in this series, but are India at risk of overloading Rishabh Pant? He was limping through most of the first test against New Zealand. And even when Jarrell played him in Perth, Pant still took the gloves. Given he has knee and ankle problems from his car accident, should India be looking at Jarrell Ishan Kishan to preserve his long-term fitness? It's an interesting one. I saw a couple of people saying how badly he kept in the fourth innings, which I think is fair. There was a little bit of inconsistent bounce at times, but he really did struggle quite a bit. It's a tough one because I think he feels a freedom when he's wicket-keeping that he might not feel if he's a specialist batter on the side. So, you know, that was always Adam Gilchrist talked about this a lot of and. You get it with attacking wicketkeepers. I know Matt Pryor felt this as well. Like, if you know you're in the job for the other skill, you can attack and push the tempo a little bit more, which is what India want of Rishabh Pant, right? Like, it's other than him being left-handed, it's those are the two most important things. They could find someone else to average mid-40s, right? Most probably. maybe not, but at least around his average. But those two skills take him to a whole different level. And so, and that's before you factor in the keeping. So you kind of want him to continue, I would assume. But your point is there. He's not moving brilliantly at the moment. And I don't think anyone would argue that. KG says, what are Boomer's true stats? Oh, I meant to send this one to Byron and I didn't. Considering we're now in a bowler-friendly era, how do his numbers hold up against Marshall and Gunn? I tell you what, Byron is on this chat. Byron can go and look that up. And then we'll do that question last because I did mean to send it to Byron and I forgot. Ian says, there's a lot of talk of Headingley being a difficult ground to catch at this week. I did see that. Is there anything to this or can we follow this with clouds and saliva make balls hoop around corners? No, there are definitely difficult catching grounds. There are grounds with weird backgrounds. So one of the reasons that it is hard to catch a ball that is skied at night compared to in the daytime is because the ball goes into like a black void, right? And you don't have, I'm looking for the correct, you don't have the depth perception that you would normally have. There are grounds and parts, it's not always the whole ground, but there are elements of different grounds where it just isn't as easy to see. And I think we saw in the NBA, and this is when they had the lockdown season, when they had the lockout, not the lockout, the COVID season, I think everyone started shooting three-pointers better. I think I'm right in saying this. And they thought that the empty gyms played a part in that because generally when you are shooting a three-pointer, you are in an empty gym, right? So you are not used to seeing the sort of the colors behind, the movement behind and everything else. That's a very hard thing to replicate, right? And there are stadiums where when you have people in them, suddenly it is harder to pick up the ball than when there are no people in them. And then conversely, I think is sometimes is the opposite. You know, you can have maybe it's not so much that you have red square to the wicket or anything. You might just have pockets where it just the depth perception isn't quite the same. Whether Headingley is one of them, Ian, is the one that we don't know. And the best way of doing that, of course, would be for cricketers to go through all their catching data and to see if there is any sort of patterns or anything within that. And that's a good way of doing it. But yeah, I think it's an interesting one. You know, every ground has like, we think of international grounds as just like sort of being very basic, but they're not. So, you know, you'll talk to fast bowlers and they'll say things like the outfield is spongy here and it ruins my rhythm, right? Obviously you have slopes in various parts of the world. You also have some grounds that where the pitch is way higher than the rest of the ground. And I think Headingley might be one of those. All of those grounds are different and they're going to give you separate challenges. And we know this, you know, as well through something like baseball, where, you know, the betting industry in baseball is so strong that we have all this other information available to us, but we don't quite do that in cricket at the moment. I mean, the money bet on cricket is massive, but the science of trying to work these things out for betting companies doesn't seem as high. I know some betting companies have tried some pretty fancy things, but betting syndicates, I should say. Anyway, person says, dumb novice test question. What decides what day of the week a test match will start? I know this is the third Australia-West Indies starts on Saturday. Is there like a broadcast or rest period for this? It seems odd to start on a Saturday. It's all down to the home team. Obviously, it's not quite all down to the home team because you have the combination of both teams have to agree. But yeah, it essentially comes down to what you're trying to do. That like a test might start on a Saturday, but you might have a situation where there is a Monday public holiday. So you might be getting the 3-day public holiday and then thinking, well, the fourth day might not matter. But it's generally to do with how long the two teams have to play each other and how they can fit them in. So this is the argument for the 4-day tests, right? Like the strongest argument for the 4-day test has always been the same, which is we could start every test match on a Thursday and end everyone on a Sunday. The issue with that is not all test matches end on Sundays, right? So you would lose some of your Sunday. But overall, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Right? You know, the first 2 days are generally when test fans go, and then the weekends is the other time that they go. So now you're saying maybe at least three days of that test match should be well attended and should be well viewed. That's the idea of that thing. But yeah, they can be a bit arbitrary. We've seen them. Is it Bangladesh? I want to say it's Bangladesh, which have a lot of test matches starting on Mondays, I want to say, or Tuesdays. So, yeah, you know, some of it is cultural. Some of it is location-based. Some of it is schedule-based. Yeah. Sandeep says, good series of podcasts on how overcast conditions have less impacted than attributed to swing, starting with the Briggs and the discussion in the other pods. Any other interesting topics that you can't wait to dispel? I mean, that's kind of what I always do, Sandeep. Like, you know, I'm always looking for things. And it's not about dispelling them. Sometimes it's about proving them. I reckon I did a big piece for Cricket Info about left-right combinations and how bowlers have got so used to them, they don't quite have the impact that old cricketers think they do. Weirdly enough, they've come back through matchups now anyway, so they've actually come back in a different way. But yeah, that is certainly something that I think is worth talking about. I'm trying to think if there's any other. I'd have to go through my list of all the pieces that we have lined up, but I can't think of anything else that I have specifically in the bag at the moment on that sort of stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when you pick these things up, you then, you know, you try and follow them as far as possible, right? And I think I've tried to do, you know, what is a drop worth in cricket? Left hand, right hand batting combinations. Trying to think what else I've done. I'm sure there's like bunches of others of those kinds, but when they come up, you kind of, yeah, go with them. And they, you know, it really is just about finding the topic or the, sometimes I should say with a lot of those, it is hard to prove. So the big one that we wanted to do, which I talked to Crickviz about doing it together, I'm trying to remember what it was now. It actually might've been the clouds one. That was a big one. And we just couldn't quite get all the information that we needed at that time. You know, with Aaron having extra availability to put balls in machines and cut them in half and everything, he was a bit advanced on that. I still think there's a lot to be done around risk management in T20 cricket and one day cricket probably as well. As in, we're still seeing teams getting runouts, whereas perhaps what we should be seeing is teams having more players go out smashing the ball. Like, I don't know if there's something around that. Aravind says, been following your work since the Cricket with Balls days. You are old, Aravind. I really appreciate the content you put out. Thank you very much. With the improving understanding of bowling biomechanics, do you think that at some point in the future, a coach could take a 140, 150 bowler and tweak elements of their action and manufacture an extra 10 to 20 kilometers? It's oversimplifying things a little bit, Aravind, but we have seen players put on 8 to 10 Ks before. Right, like I think Saudi found an extra 8 to 10 Ks. I think Chris Wokes found an extra 8 to 10 Ks. There was a period of time where it felt like everywhere Alan Donald went, there was a bowler who would pick up pace. Unrit Nokia, he might be the one that had the most. His was about 10 or 15. CS might remember that, but he really put on a lot of extra pace. So yeah, it is possible. There's Stefan, the guy who works with this young Sharma, whose name Stefan Jones is it? I hope I got that right. You know, I think him and people like Ian Pont, there's a few people out there who believe that it's possible to get people quicker using biomechanics, using methods, you know, bringing in things from other sports and everything else. So yeah, I do think that's the case. You also have to remember is, are we making the bowler better, or are we just making them faster? Like, are they losing other things? I know one bowler who I think had worked with Stefan and, you know, looked into everything, and he's like, when he did it, he was a little bit quicker, but he didn't feel like he was as accurate or as skillful as he had been before. And so he was like, okay, what do I want to be? Where do I want to fit in? And he decided to go on the other side. So yeah, I do think you can go faster. I don't think that is the only thing. I think we will see in the future more people like Pont and Stefan, and I'm sure there's some others out there. I mean, I mentioned Alan Donald off the top of my head as well. I think we'll see more people like them who have the ability to make people faster, but then we'll also see another whole bowling coach coming through who will be a skills bowling coach. We haven't quite got there yet, but someone like Benny Howe would be perfectly set up to do a job like that, right? But there are probably, you know, other bowlers as well who are really good at that, those sorts of things, and we might start to see them as well. All right, let's take a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, and I'll see you in a moment. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night, or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. Ben says, how many cricketers never play again after they retire? On the flip side, how many former test players continue to play club cricket forever? I love the idea of a test quality player now 60 playing against normal people. So the one I know that definitely does this is, and I think he must have retired by now, but was the Australian player from Melbourne, Julian Wiener, who I reckon in his 50s was still playing club cricket. Played during the World Series thing, was, you know, a plucky sort of first-class batter who probably played slightly ahead of his himself in test cricket, but certainly put a high, you know, very highly skilled working sort of first-class cricketer. He's the one I know of. I'm trying to think if there's any others. You've got to remember that by the, if you think about what club cricket is, it's a once-a-week game, right? So you play on Sundays. So some people who play for like 40 years, right? So in England, that's probably more than that. In England, there are people who quite regularly play for, you know, 50 years, 60 years, right? They start playing when they're 10 or 11 and they're still, you know, I'm playing with some guys who, I played cricket with some guys who are in their 60s, I would say. I don't think I've ever played with anyone in their 70s, but there have been players who played in their 70s. You're still only playing, you know, 20 to 25 days a week, days a year, right? Maybe if they play Saturday, Sundays, you know, it's slightly more than that. A professional cricketer, and I'm not just talking about the amount of time they're playing, but also the amount of time they're training. You're looking at someone then who is playing, you know, 100 days a year, maybe, and then training another 80 to 100 days a year. So even when they love cricket, when they get to the other end, it's kind of emotionally exhausting, right? And, you know, they've played so much cricket by the end that they just, it doesn't work the same way that I think people think it might. Now, that's not to say that there aren't, like, you know, England's maybe one of the most famous for this, of like having these sort of charity matches with older players and they will pop in. You've got guys like Alex Tudor, who literally, like, he plays in corporate games all the way, like he's a teacher during the year and then he plays in corporate games all the way through the summer and makes, you know, and does very well for himself. So there is an element of that existing and continuing. But again, those are charity games, or they're playing them for everyone else. Club cricket's kind of a different beast. And I think most former players would probably prefer not to play club cricket for a variety of reasons. You become a target and everything else. And, but yeah, so some do continue to play, but they don't specifically continue to play, in league cricket or club cricket in that kind of way. Then you've got the others who just, the game has just, you know, they've retired. Their body no longer does what it used to do. They're not feeling particularly great. And maybe at the end of their time, they felt like their career could have gone in a different direction. You know, all these sorts of things. Those sorts of players quite often never play again. And the ones with the bad injuries or that their body can't do it. Like, I now have to work on my own emotional state of being like, I cannot play cricket the way that I used to play cricket. And so it's really frustrating to me to be like, well, I should be able to still be handy, but some days that just doesn't work. Like, I just can't field the way that I used to field. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to bowl leg spin the way that I did. And even if I bowl leg spin now, like maybe two overs of leg spin is the most I have in me anymore, consistently anyway. You know, my batting has changed, you know, all these different things. For some of those guys, like they, you know, Robbie talks about this all the time. Your ego, your whole personality is in you being a cricketer. So if you come back and you're not being a cricketer like that anymore, you've lost it. So yeah, there are players who certainly do it, and there are many other players who don't. Most people retire and that's it, and they give their body a rest, but they'll play in some fun games and everything else. I think Mark Butcher played in a game. I can't remember if I played with him, but I remember he was going to play in a game or whatever. No, he just played in a game because I asked him to play in a game. And he said, I don't think I'll ever play again. It's not that he doesn't love cricket, because he watches tons of cricket and follows cricket and you know, he's very much, but I just don't think he enjoyed playing in that game. And it's not the same for them. And I kind of get it as a writer a little bit too. It's just different if I'm doing something. Like, I don't write great emails to people. I don't write great cards quite often to people or letters to people or anything like that. And part of the reason is that it's like all my energy goes into the actual writing. Remember Gareth Batty, I asked him to play in a game once. And he did, to be fair. He played in a couple of games with me. But he was like, you're really getting into this. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, I can't. He goes, it's not what I do. It's, you know, it's not our version of cricket, which is very fair. Lemon says, watching Ben Stokes bowl, he seems to have a very pure outswing seam. Is the only seamer in the big three who consistently bowls swing rather than normal ball? Yeah, he's stuck with it. I don't know if the wobble ball didn't work for him, but I reckon that's a possibility. I've said this before. You don't have to bowl the wobble ball either. Like, if you're a good swing bowler, like Mohammed Shami doesn't bowl the... I would say Mohammed Shami would be the other guy that wouldn't bowl it as much. Obviously, Mitchell Starc with the new ball might be another one. Although he's starting to do it a lot more now. He's starting to put it together a little bit more. But yeah, I think there was... I think people are like, oh, you have to bowl the wobble ball. And you don't really have to. I think it's a good secondary skill to have if you are a very good swing bowler. Like, I think for someone like Ashdeep or Ben Stokes, Shardul would be another one. I'm trying to think of some other players. Then you could... Having that as a secondary skill. But if you can swing the ball, it's less people try and swing it now. So it should actually be more valuable. So, it could just be that Stokes couldn't pick it up. Not everyone actually picks it up brilliantly, and not everyone likes bowling it either. It doesn't really suit his style, because his style is kind of extreme bowling, right? Like, it's a big hooping out swinger wide of the off stump. It's an in-swinging Yorker back at the toes of leg stump, right? It's a surprise short ball. It's, you know, all these different things. That's not really what the wobble ball is, right? Mob says, if New Zealand cricket are such geniuses at handling resources, why are they being such redacted when it comes to Ajaz Patel not getting a contract? The contrast between Bashir's generously long leash and poor Ajaz's dog box could not be more stark. Mitchell Starc. You can be geniuses at managing resources and not nail every decision, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, they can't. No one has ever said New Zealand has made every decision right. Secondly, is Ajaz Patel likely to retire without a contract? Probably not. I don't think you can really compare him to Shoaib Bashir, though, because in Shoaib Bashir, what England are trying to come up with is a spin bowler who can bowl in all three different... who can bowl in on flat pitches, on Asian pitches, and on standard pitches that allow them. That's not what Ajaz Patel is to begin with. And also, in Shoaib Bashir, you're talking about someone who is still in development. Whereas with Ajaz Patel, you know exactly what he is. Like, my guess is that they could just say, well, we'll just pick him again, right? As long as they don't think he's going to be gone from the game. He seems like, to me, I think I've only interviewed him once. He seemed like, to me, the sort of guy that just absolutely loves the game, you know, wants to be involved with it and everything else. You've got to pick your battles. There's only so many players you could contract, even in New Zealand, right? Like, you probably got to, you know, do that. And it's very possible that there's some sort of conversation that they've had with him as well. I mean, where they've said, look, we are still going to pick you, but we don't necessarily need you as a contracted player because we might only pick you once in the next 2-year cycle. And by that stage, you will be this age, right? But that doesn't mean we're not going to pick you because you're not contracted. I kind of feel with the younger players, you have to be a bit more careful with the contracts. With the older players, I think you can be a little bit more flexible. He will probably go off and play county cricket, I'm assuming, as well. He's certainly done that before, hasn't he? Rudra says, if Stokes played for India, where would they fit him into the 11? The biggest problem for them would be him and Rishabh Pant batting in similar positions and Ravi Jadeja, right? Because you've then got a bunch of left-handers in a row. So I suppose you would have to rejig the batting order a little bit if that was the case. But let's pretend that he's not left-handed and we're just talking about skill. He would bat at 6, wouldn't he? You'd bat him behind... Would you bat him behind Rishabh? You bat one of them at 5, one of them at 6, with Jadeja at 7. Or you could move everyone down a position. You could almost move Rishabh back to 7, play Jadeja at 8, and you Stokes at 5 with like a specialist batter at 6, right? Giving yourself incredible flexibility to do whatever you want on a game by game. I mean, what Stokes would really give India is what Jadeja has given India and what Ashwin briefly gave India, which is just ultimate flexibility. Right? Now, if you had Jadeja and Stokes on the same side, you could kind of do anything with your lineup by a game. You can carry a player in your lineup. Connor says, do you know of any bat manufacturers who have used a hexagonal shape for the handle, like tennis rackets? Thought it might make it easier for batters to get more consistent grip. So I reckon there was a period in the 70s and 80s, and I'm not an expert on this, but I'm pretty sure there was a period in the 70s and 80s, maybe 80s. There was a lot of experiments done with grips. I don't know if John Houghton's written about this or Rusty Jackson has written about this, but I think there was quite a bit of flexibility. If you go now, Connor, like, I would say grips are already a lot different than they have ever been before. Again, if you go to a cricket store now and you pick up bunch of bats. It's remarkable to me how much different the grips are. And they are really changing quite dramatically every time. Like even when I pick up kids' bats, you know, really noticing how different they are. So I think people are still doing it. There's probably a reason why you don't want it like a tennis racket, but I would be shocked if no one's tried that. You know, there's a lot of experimental bat manufacturers out there at the lower level, not the big ones. Sandeep says, can you please share any interesting tidbits from World Cricket Connects that you heard from your friends or community? I suppose the one that we all know is that it's called World Cricket Connects, and then they didn't allow any media in. I think that's it's such a stupid thing to do, right? On multiple levels. One, there are plenty of people in the media who can actually help. Two, half the people there were commentators anyway, who are in the media. So I think Athers and Gideon got in, and they were the only two that I'm aware of. I know there was certainly some elements of, this is my issue of, I have no problem with you asking me media members there and asking them not to report on it, which is, I believe, what happened, but I'm not 100% sure. You'd have to ask Gideon. I did talk to him about it, but I've now forgotten. But I have no element of that. But you can't call it World Cricket Connects and not have fans and media represented. So that was just, once you do something like that, it's a, you know, it is what it is. What else? Obviously, the Jay Shah thing was supposed to be there and he wasn't there. I think Vishal Misra has written all about that. And that is, again, it kind of defeats the purpose of having the thing if you're going to do that. What else did I hear? I didn't hear that much else, honestly, Sandeep. I'm not all that interested. I'm sure more things will come out when I talk to people. Let's have another break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back shortly for more of cricket.
If you need your pitch change, well, NordVPN can doctor any surface to a new location so that your IP address is set for you to win. Want to watch a game on a free stream in another hemisphere? Give NordVPN the ball. Or if you just want to watch a clip on social media that a cricket board won't allow, promote NordVPN to pinch hit. So if you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a bowler protects the boundaries in the death overs with nordvpn.com/Kimber today.
Rob says, reading the history of Test cricket, do you put any credibility into the claims that Bradman has 4 missing runs from inaccurate scorecards that would get his average up to 100? It's more than possible. Yeah, I mean, I do think international scorers are pretty good, right? You know, test scorers and everything else. I really think that, you know, they are. It's a very high level of scoring. But going back, like, yeah, there's always a possibility of doing that, of a mistake. There's also a possibility that he has 4 less runs, right? I would assume if you go through the, especially up until 2000. I think in the cricket info era, it probably does change quite a bit. So maybe from 95 onwards, but certainly from 2000 onwards, right? I think if you look at before then, I'm sure there are inaccuracies in every single player's record. I think there are still inaccuracies now. Certainly at the associate level, we see inaccuracies. I remember looking at cricket info stats once and comparing them to the CPL official stats, and they were different. How is that the case? Like, right? So, yeah, I would assume, Rob, that every single player has a slightly different record than what we have. So, yeah, it is possible that Bradman made 4 more runs. It is possible that Bradman made 4 fewer runs. Neil says, thoughts on Jake Lehman, the batter. Was he or is he a potential Australian player? I've never really had him that high in my list. I think he's a talented first-class player, and I could see, I could certainly see why he is... you know, being a professional for a long period of time, but he's 32 years old. He averages 34. I would have to look at his more recent records just to see if anything has changed. I see he's made what 300s. It was in a row. I thought there was another match in between. So he's in form at the moment. Just don't know if you want, he's almost 33. I think he's just worked out his batting at a good level at the moment. I've never thought he was a bad player. But I've never thought he was an international quality player. Being that his biggest problem is probably Where's he been batting recently? Let me just see if he's been batting in any different position. Because his biggest issue is going to be where he bats, right? Because, yeah, he's batting at like six in some of these games. If you're batting at number six and you're 33 and you're averaging 34, you're not going to play for Australia and you should not be playing for Australia. But regardless of that, his biggest problem is he's a middle order player. You have to be a great middle order player to break into this Australian side at the moment. Like, there's two all-rounders that they're trying to fit in there. Maybe Mitch Marsh, if they want to go back to Mitch Marsh. Travis Head, finding middle order players for Australia, not an issue at all. Inglis, Smith, right? Finding top order players is the issue. And I don't think Jake Lehman's a top order player. PJ says, well, I haven't read your book yet, despite pre-ordering. Thanks, Jeff Bezos. I know a lot of people are buying me Amazon and maybe I should allow them. I think it might be slightly more to do with Bloomsbury. But that's how these things are. It's very hard to make an international book on a small level. Like, it's easy if you're like Harry Potter and you make sure that every country in the world has the book ready to go. But when you're in a, you know, when you're not, you know, when you're not J.K. Rowling, when you believe that trans people are struggling and deserve their own rights, if you're not on that level, it means your books aren't going to be going as, even if they get sold in multiple markets, and most of my books have eventually been sold in multiple markets, it's kind of an afterthought. But anyway, I don't know what that had to do with anything. I do like how you gave a ranking range for the batters in the book. Like, player X could be as high as Y or as low as Z, depending on certain factors. But of course, at the end of the day, there can only be one number one in Bradman. However, for the bowling book, I feel like there could be a legitimate claims for and compelling arguments for 10 players to be as high as number one on the ranking range. Have you had a chance to do a deeper dive into some of the bowling number one claims yet? No. I haven't signed the deal. I have sketched an outline of what the book is. I know what the chapters are, more or less. And I started to ask some people to be, if they would be interested in being interviewed. So I think Jimmy, Sean Pollock, Ian Bishop, off the top of my head, have all said yes. Damien Fleming obviously said yes. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that I've talked to. I haven't gone on the big thing of like trying to make sure I can uncover each bowler, but Harmy will say yes. Goffey will say yes. I've worked with Kirtley a couple of times. So that, I'm kind of in my head, I put together the rough list. So I've got like a 3-tier list of players that I definitely know will talk to me, players who I would really like to talk to, but maybe don't know particularly well or don't have a contact to, but I think if I get through to them, I can get them. And then I've got like a dream list at the bottom. So that's kind of the level of planning I've got to for that book at the moment. Last time I really over-indexed on the list first and then wrote the book. I don't think the book came out worse for it, but I think the writing process is wrong. I just think I wasted a lot of time on the list, whereas actually what I want to do with this book is talk to as many people as possible, get as much information as possible, write the book, and then be like, okay, how do we nail the numbers individually? But you're right. I don't know if I have 10 players who I have a claim as being number one. I suppose you'd have Barnes, Marshall, McGrath, Murley, Warne, Hadley. Am I missing? You wouldn't probably put Bumrah there at the moment, but Bumrah will eventually push for that. Stain is probably an outsider for number one as well. Garner is an interesting case. I don't think he's quite a number one. So there's about 9 off the top of my head. Bill O'Reilly is another really interesting one on that as well. So yeah, there's a bunch. That's the thing. If you throw Lohman in, then you probably are 10. I don't know if that's your 10, but that's just off the top of my head. I think a lot of those players have a claim to be number one. I think I'll probably be slightly more harsh on that. But the Thinking Basketball podcast, which is of course one of the inspirations for how I made the list in the first place. I remember them doing something where they were looking at different play and how many players actually had a claim to be number one of all time. And I think that's how you have to do the bowling one. I think you have to go into it from that perspective. It's very fascinating. James says, love the double century podcast you used to do. It's likely to come back at any time. Yeah, it's mostly about finances at the moment, James. I don't have time to sit down and write double century episodes anymore. I don't have the money to pay someone like Abhishek Mukherjee to do it for me anymore. I have a partnership with another blogger, and I probably now have enough money to go to him and get some of his stuff. I might wait until the end of this summer. So I've got, the end of this summer, then I've got the Women's World Cup, and then I've got the Ashes. So yeah, I might be able to do it, start it up again there. I obviously love the podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do. It's definitely something that we want to get back to. And it's just looking at how we do it in the future. I was expecting to have had a series out by now because I did the Kerry Packer documentary for Channel 9, the World Series cricket documentary. And I was going to do a series of Double Century off the back of that. Obviously, that has not been released yet. And so they don't really want me doing the podcast yet, which is absolutely fine. I completely understand that. Not that the podcast is directly related to the thing, but it's just all the research I had and, you know, being able to go through and do all that. So that's what I would like to do with Double Century. So that's one season that's pretty much done. And then the old Ebor block is the other one that we've got. I've done a partnership with. I need to get in touch with Giles again now and just be like, okay, because I think I have enough money to get that back up and running. Then it's about recording them as well. It might also be in the future that, like, I think there's multiple ways of doing it. And I think we can do Double Century in a slightly different way going ahead. But yeah, I definitely don't want it to die. I think it's a really important project. And the problem with Double Century is that Overthrowing Cricket's Empire didn't sell as many copies as we wanted it to. I don't know how many copies it sold, but it didn't sell enough copies for us to be like, what I wanted to be able to do is be able to write maybe 3 series a year, pick the best series, make a book out of it, and then make the money back for Double Century through the book sales. At the moment, that has not happened. I understand a lot more about book sales now than I did before, but I'm not sure that will particularly work. But that's kind of the way I was trying to fund it. But, you know, my business has so many different random patterns to it that who knows. Ben says, why do TV commentators stay the score at the end of the over? It's on the bottom of the screen at all times. It's just a hang up from radio or another reason. Not everyone looks at the graphics. It's a good way of finishing the punctuation. It is a bit of a hang up from radio. But yeah, I think it's a good way of letting everyone know that we're going to a break mentally without us going to a break. So I think that's another part of it. I don't think they do it every single over on cable TV, but on the ones where there are ads, I think you'll see it a bit more. But yeah, it's as a cricket commentator from radio, and I haven't done it TV, but you don't have to. Like, if you listen to radio, radio says the score a lot more, right? You might, in a one-day game, you might say the score 2 or 3 times an over. In a test match, you might say 1 or 2 times an over. So you still don't need to say it at the end of the over, but it allows the listener or the viewer to know it's the end of the over, right? There's a natural bookend there. So I think it's partly that as well. Mob says, thoughts on Jake Weatherall, a southpaw who bowls leggies as a potential test candidate. He's another heralding from Darwin. So a couple of years ago, Jake Weatherall, and I think this was during lockdown, really interested me in the way that he was going about his cricket. I've been following him a little bit in the Big Bash show. I know that he's a fairly talented player. He's just another one of these guys who just hasn't made runs consistently, right? Like, he just hasn't had the big years. He's probably more interesting to me in that he's about to turn 31, so he's a little bit earlier. But you're still talking about a guy who's played, you know, largely in South Australia, who's averaging, 36 in first-class cricket. His bowling, I wouldn't be too interested in. I don't know how much he's ever bowled. He's taken 1 first-class wicket. So yeah, I'm not too worried about him as a bowler. As a batter, I think he's the sort of guy that will go on to be a really interesting coach. I don't know if he's going to make it to the top level, but my guess is not. But if they go on a pattern of cycling through a couple of first-class players, he might be the sort of player that gets cycled through, right? Like, at the top of the order. Richard says, surely if conditions are anything like this, it would make more sense to pick Kuldeep over Tucker, right? Yeah, but if you look at the first couple of days, it's an interesting one. A lot of people have said this. It also would have made more sense to pick Akash Deep in the first couple of days. In fact, Harshit Rana would make sense. He's going home. Does that mean he's injured? I'm not sure. But it would have made more sense to pick one of those guys than Shuttle. I said from the start that these weren't the kind of pitches that you wanted for someone like Shuttle. So that's the issue with picking him is you're picking him based on the fact that he's an England-style bowler when the wickets are not English-style. Oops. Oh. Rob says, why is Lord still so sloped? Some combination of English quirkiness and the cost to redo the surface and sands. No, you could easily redo it. That's not an issue at all. Yeah, it's one of these things of... trying to think of the best way of putting this. It's a bit like, why is Wimbledon still wear whites, right? There are things that happen at Lords that don't happen anywhere else, partly because it's tradition and partly because it is a marketing gimmick, right? They've managed to keep onto traditions because they are establishment people who don't want things to change, right? Like, let's not piss about the bush here. That is one of the larger reasons that that has happened, right? But within that, once you do that, you end up being traditional, and that becomes the marketing point, right? Like, you know, a lot of Wimbledon and Lords' appeal is the fact that you are going back in time, right? You are entering a different world. And, you know, Lords, certainly at the end that I'm usually at, you know, the nursery end, is a very modern ground in many different ways. And, you know, it has a lot of the amenities, but it still has the bench seats, right? And it still has the members in front of the side screen, and it still has cork bottles being splattered onto the ground, and, you know, all those sorts of things. You can still bring in actual alcohol to the ground, right? Craziness in can't take a backpack into a music venue anymore, but you can take a full bottle of champagne into a cricket ground, right? And so within that, there is that then becomes the marketing gimmick, right? Like, Lords is different than everywhere else. And so I think they've largely kept it because of that. They wanted to keep the fence too. They were the last people. They had the little hill up to the fence. They wanted the fence. Obviously, so many players had hurt themselves on fences. It was just, you know, with the diving, it was never going to happen. But yeah, so I think it makes sense to keep some of those things. And you see it with American sports. American sports is quite weird because it's so gung-ho about, you know, great stadiums and going forward to the future and, you know, all these different things, right? And walking into the event with your ticket somewhere in your pocket and, you know, and having Steve Ballmer have AI robots pick you up and put you in your seat or whatever the hell, right? But they also, American sports is very good at realizing that there are certain traditions that are also marketable and that do take people back in time. Like, you know, and baseball is a really good example of this. But little things you see in basketball as well, right? Like, there is an element of, yeah, we could do things very, very differently. But people still like some of the traditional aspects of that. And I think they're really good at that and understanding that at Lords. PJ says, is there a certain etiquette or unwritten rule when it comes to giving out free copies of your book to your friends in the cricket media? Cricket media is a relatively tiny industry. Are you all expected to buy each other's books? Do you give out a free copy if you promote a book on someone's channel, or only if they write a review for the book? How does this work? There's no real hard and fast rule. You know, I offered a free book to a journalist the other day, and he's just like, don't waste it on me. I probably won't read it, right? Like, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing. Like, I don't want to give someone a book if they're not going to read it. I don't give it to them just on the idea of, like, I've given Andy Bull the book, right? I'm pretty sure I gave Andy the book. I've given Andy Bull the book because I think he'll find it interesting, and maybe one day he'll be writing a column and he'll be like, but in Jared Kimber's The Art of Batting, fine. But also, I think he will find it interesting, and you know, that might start more conversations between me and Andy, right? So Lawrence Booth, I gave the book. I don't think the Daily Mail or Wisdom might do something on it, but the Daily Mail was going to do anything on it from Lawrence's end, right? But again, me and Lawrence have already had some other conversations that have come out of that because he has read the book, right? So for me, that's not just the sum game of, can I get a review? Can I get a mention? Can I get a whole article written on it? That's kind of the dream, right? Like, where you give it to Athers and he writes, he uses your book as an inspiration to write an article, and then everyone reads the article. Because that's going to work better than a review. But that's not the way I would go into it. I'll be like, you know, I find certain people that I just think will be interested in the book. Like, I gave it one to Mark Pugach because I've known Pugach for ages, and I thought it might be the sort of thing that he would like. And he loved the book and put a tweet out about it. But if he'd loved the book and not put a tweet out about it, I still would have been pretty happy. Like, I still think he would have found a way to, you know, mention it maybe in one of his podcasts, or, you know, when he's commentating one time, or, you know, when he's doing something else, you know, cricket events or whatever. So I would never say, here's a book, you have to tweet it or Instagram about it or fit it into one of your columns. So you're trying to put it in the people that you think, in the hands of the people you think would be interested in it, right? And then from there, hopefully something does come of it. But if it doesn't, it's fine. As far as buying books, there are some cricket journalists who love buying people's books. I think they do see it, as you said, as this thing. The problem is that, like, I've been working in cricket for 17 years. I would go broke buying everyone's book, right? Like, I'm not taking a piss here. I would literally go broke if I had to buy everyone's book. There are so many cricket books coming out at any one time. And I get most of my books just come to me for free, not even from the author. I'm just on so many lists of who to send cricket books to. And Red Inca has changed that a lot of recent times. But even, you know, even when I was at Crick Info, I would get a lot of these books in the same way that I would give it to Andy Ball. People would give me their books. And it probably has worked, you know, like I think of I forget the name of the book, but the one about the history of no balls. I've talked about that book a lot. The Strange History of English Leg Spin. I've never met that author. I don't know him at all, but I've quoted from that book a couple of times. I'm trying to think of some of the others. You know, Rod Lyle's book is perfect. Is another example of like, I'm the perfect person to send that book to, right? And now I might not have got those guys on. I'm naming three books that I know I've mentioned. There's probably been 20 other books that have been given to me that I haven't done anything. So Cricket Across Dark Waters is over here by Arun Singh Gupta. And I just haven't. I don't think I've even flicked through it yet. It's on my desk. If you have a look at any of the studio shots we do, you can literally see this book. And I just haven't had time to pick it up yet or have a go through it. But I might, right? And maybe if I do, it will influence that and I will put it in a column. You know, Tim Wigmore's probably a better one to talk to about this, but you kind of just want the book to be out there and available for people to think about. And maybe it gives them a paragraph or an intro into their piece or whatever. But yeah, I'm more interested in someone like Andy Bull or Gideon Haig. I gave one to DK. I gave one to Bish. Like, people I think will actually want to read it or be interested in reading it. I'm less interested in just giving it to famous people who are definitely not going to read it, right? I'm not going to give this book to Harmy. If Harmy asks for one, he can have one, right? But I'm not going to give it to Harmy because I just don't think Harmy's going to want to read it, right? And so and it's the same with some cricket writers. As I said, there was a cricket writer who just was really honest. He was like, I just don't think I'll get around to reading it. That's more than fine. But if there's another cricket writer who contacts me and says, can I get a copy of the book? Fine. Some people don't want a copy of the book. A lot of people just ask for the PDF, right? So I sent the PDF to a couple of people in the last couple of days. One person asked, one person didn't, but I was like, actually, I should have put you on the original list. You might like this. Anyway, have a look at this. So yeah, there's no real rhyme or reason. It's not an art. I don't get that many free copies. So I want to say I've had 20 to 30 free copies so far. And then separate to that, you get a lot that the publisher will send out. So there's probably been, and this is the ones I know, maybe 50 to 100 free copies have been sent out, right? I don't know if Bloomsbury has sent a bunch of others out. Like, I know there's a bunch of people who do, you know, sports book awards and stuff who probably have them that I don't even know about these people. And they, you know, possibly all have those books as well. Remember, you used to go into the Crick Info desks and there would just be piles, right, of these books over and over again. And it's like, how do they even get through them, right? How do they even read them in some cases? So there's no rhyme or reason. You're just trying to keep it in the conversation. So what we've done at the moment is we've kind of, I mean, Mark Pugach is probably not a great example of this, but, you know, getting it to a couple of people outside of cricket is probably the next step. So you want to kind of start the hype a little bit and everything within cricket. That's the way that I look at it. That's why I've tried to do all the different cricket podcasts and, you know, I did BBC World Series and all World Service and all these different things. You know, within cricket, you want to do as much as you can. Then, separate to that, I think what you start to do is you start to push it out into different directions, right? So you have a situation where, like, you know, there are some other famous people I know who might want the book. So you try and get them a copy of the PDF or the book itself. Then you know, there are people who are cricket fans, but it might be their second or third sport, but they work in other parts of the media and you keep going through. You know, you're just trying to keep it in a conversation for as long as possible, but then eventually for the book to sort of find its momentum. So what we found with this book so far, and I haven't checked the numbers, but it had a huge boost at the start. right? And a lot of that was because I had this incredible social media. You know, I keep putting it up on the screen here, right? And so people went out and bought it. They pre-ordered it. It sold really well. It obviously went to number two in the cricket charts in the UK, I think, went to number one in India, despite the fact that you couldn't even get the paper book at that stage. And that's the hardcore Good Areas, Jared Kimber followers, right? They went and bought it. Now what we need is the general cricket fans, and I'm already starting to get emails from people who have said, I've never heard of you before. This book came on my radar, right? Then you want to be able to get them to get it. And then if it keeps going beyond that, that's when you want it to become one of those cricket books that sort of sticks around forever, right? So is it Cricketomics is probably a good example of this in cricket. You know, Inverting the Pyramid, which we've talked about before in this podcast. That's that next level. And that's the stickiness, which allows you to do any project you want kind of into the future, right? Where you can literally say, I have this great idea, but I've sold X amount of copies of this other book. Will you give me a go and do that? And so, yeah, getting it into the hand, I'm trying to think of some of the other people that I've given it to, but getting it into the hands of Adam Collins and Dan Gallen, Neil Manthorpe, whatever, they might not all be able to do something on it, right? But getting it to them is a much better way of starting than not getting it to them. And, you know, sometimes you don't know which people will like it or not. Let us take another break. And when we come back, we will mop up with any of the super chats if there are some. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel.
And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your two times ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win.
Also get to this true stats one. Hopefully, Varun, I've just sent him a message, so hopefully Varun has those. But it's a couple of super chats here. Sorab says, are we ever going to see a joint podcast with Good Areas and the Great Kicker? Are you all friends? Yeah, I've known them since they were a Twitter account, really. It's funny if we have, we had lots of chats last week and I had talked to Sam about coming on the podcast and talking about the book and we didn't get a chance. I've been on The Great Cricketer before. I don't think I've ever had the boys on. I don't know if they do other people's podcasts, actually. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't, but I don't know if that's their thing. I know Sam a lot better than I know Higo, but I know Higo quite well. Yes is the answer. It's probably just been laziness. Laziness is the wrong way of putting it. We've both been really, both sets of, things have been really busy. But yeah, I've known them for ages. Tried to help them out early on and then they kind of exploded and probably now they need to help me out. But yeah, we have talked about doing some stuff before, but it's never quite gone together. But yeah, we are friends. Sam's been in my house and had a barbecue here and I told him to take this shit seriously because I thought he was really good at it. And I think he went home and did a marketing job. But he has finally taken it seriously, so I feel vindicated there. They've done incredibly well over a long period of time now in multiple formats as well, which I know sounds silly, but like a book, a podcast, a Twitter account. Uncown says, any good young talent that has caught your eye? I don't think there's anyone there at the moment that is, not wildly known. I don't think there's anyone that's coming through that I'm going to be shocking. I don't do as much sort of when I was, an analyst specifically and, a general manager, like I would just burn over clips of players and, had very, Varun, take that off the screen. We'll come to that in a minute. I think we would certainly then have, lots of different information on, players coming through and everything else. I don't do that as much now. I'd have to check my notes. There's probably a player in my notes, but I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. Ayant says, who would you be your top five full-time, all-time great wicketkeeper batters, and how do you weigh wicketkeeping versus batting? Well, when you say wicketkeeping batters, I would instantly just look at the batting, right? So, I don't think in any way, that would be Ames, Gilchrist, Pant, Flower. I'm trying to think who my fifth one would be. O's Pry is pretty high up there, isn't he? I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that I've missed. BJ Watling would be pretty high up there for me as well. I have to think about that. If you're looking at batting and the impact of batting, but if you're asking who the best wicketkeepers are of all time, which is a very different question, right? If you're looking at the best wicketkeepers of all time, and I mean that as a holistic thing, so I think you still have to factor in their batting, right? But then that's probably where someone like Alan Knott comes back in. Yeah, because Alan Knott is not quite at the level of some of these other guys with the bat, but was one of the greatest wicketkeepers in the world at that time, right? And then you've got someone like, well, how do you fit in those sorts of Prasanna Jayawardena, Bob Taylor type players, where in Bob Taylor's case, he really couldn't bat, right? And there's heaps of the older Australian wicketkeepers just could not bat at all. And where do you sort of do that? It's hard because you're going on contemporary reports of how good some of these wicketkeepers were. Like, I have seen Jack Russell, so I can do... QDK. I did forget to QDK. Yeah. So if I'm doing top five, yeah, I'd have him ahead of Pryor, wouldn't I? So I think when you go about it from that perspective, you definitely have, it's a bit harder because you are going on those older reports. But, you know, with Jack Russell, I think I know how good a wicketkeeper he was because I saw enough of him. Some of those other, certainly before Bob Taylor, you know, before there was any footage of, it's just hard to know where they come in. They're two different lists completely for me. There was someone who got really upset when I did the whole thing on Pant during the test match. And he was like, no stage was wicketkeeping mentioned. And I was like, well, we weren't talking about the wicketkeeping element of it at all. We were literally talking about what they add as batters. And I think that's a more than fine way of looking at it because we are looking at the best batting wicketkeepers in that. And, you know, we were talking about Flower and Gilchrist and Pant, right? The wicketkeeping is a completely separate article or a completely separate thing, but we were literally talking about which level that Pant had got to with the bat, and I think that's and people do get very confused. We do have that super chat from before, which I will just quickly bring back up. KJ says, what are Bumrah's true stats considering we are in a bowler friendly era? How do his numbers hold up against Marshall and Garner's true stats? We don't have true stats for anyone that we don't have ball by ball for, right? So what we do have is adjusted averages. We have match factors and, you know, era factors and all these sorts of things. You can see here that Marshall has an adjusted average of 19.04 and Garner's is 19.71 and Bumrah is 19.6. So he's right there with all those guys. There's not any big movement within that at all. Very, very similar all the way through. I would assume, well, actually this might happen to Bumrah as well. The match factor one for the West Indies is going to be really random because they had such a good overall bowling lineup that it might actually impact them a little bit. And then you've got era factor, which will be the other one. So there's a few different ways of having a look at those bowlers. You keep going through the records, right? Then you're looking at home versus away. One thing I really want to look at for bowlers is records on drawn pitches will be another one. You know, those are the sorts of things that I think that you have to come up with. All right. I think we can have one more quick break and see if there is anything else in the chat. Garner averages 22 in draws. Whoa. And every time you look at his record, he's really good. He is the most underrated player, I think. How do you average 22 in draws? That is very good. He's very good at cricket. Let's just have a quick break here and then we'll come back after the break and I'll see if there's anything else in the chat that we need to get to as well.
A few years ago, I realized that trying to find the best stories in cricket was impossible for any fan. I even tried to get funding to make my own cricket Huffington Post. It never quite worked. But luckily, we finally have someone filling this massive void in our game, Best of Cricket. They scour the publications everywhere to find, quite simply, all the best news and the greatest stories on our sport. Then they make it just as easy. They either email it or WhatsApp it direct to you. Cricket's greatest tales delivered to your device. This is truly the best of cricket.
Just seeing if there's anything else here. Ah, here we go. All right, so a couple more questions and then we'll finish up. Jessica says, Gideon is rich enough to buy his own copy. Okay, so Gideon loves reading cricket books and he does buy them. He has certainly bought copies of my book before and I bought copies of his books before, right? I want Gideon to read this book. I want to get his feedback. I want to have his conversation with me about it. I want him to talk about the book, in Cricket Hotel. I want him to write an article about it. I want him to write a review on it. I need to make sure he has it. So it's not about whether he's rich enough. Like Andy Bull gets paid a lot of money, right? Mark Pugach has a lot of money. You're trying to get the book into the hands of people who might discuss it, who might forward it, who might help you sell more copies, who might inspire other people to read it or other people to write about it, right? You need to have it in the right people's hands. It's not about rich enough, right? Like I've given it to people. I've given it to, random people that I think it could help their career, as in maybe, writing early on, if they could write a review before anyone else, that might give them a little bit leg up, or they could go to, a major publication and try and get that. And I've given it to people who are really important. It's not about whether they're rich or not. Also, Gideon was in the UK for about a week and a half. He would have had to go into a bookstore to find it because it's not available in Australia, Jessica, as I think you know, because you've bought a bunch of copies yourself. Ayat says, Jared did a deep dive on it, but the main thing, I just want to bring this up because I thought this was quite interesting about the greatest ODI batters of all time. When we're looking up these sorts of things, we are really looking up relative to the period that you play in, and that is one of the things that with Viv Richards specifically as an ODI player really makes him pop, is that his average was so much more brilliant than everyone else in his era, and his strike rate was so much more brilliant. So I don't think it's fair to say he's the Bradman of ODI cricket, but when you factor in just how ahead of his time he was, it's really hard to come up with another player from any other era who really is close. Abdullah says, I think McGrath and Marshall are perhaps a bit overrated due to them destroying England many, many times because England has the best test widespread media coverage. They got hyped up a lot. So, I don't know Malcolm Marshall's record off the top of my head, but let's just have a look at very quickly at Glenn McGrath versus all Test nations. He has an average of 24 versus Bangladesh. He has an average of 21 versus England. He has an average of 18 versus India, 25 versus New Zealand, 21 versus Pakistan, 27 versus South Africa, 22 versus Sri Lanka, 19 versus the West Indies. This is not about how good he was against England. He was better against other teams. So no, they are. In fact, I had a conversation with Tim Wigmore the other day because I think he just wants me to write the bowling book so he can read it. And we were talking about this and he was like, I don't want to say that he said Glenn McGrath is the greatest bowler of all time, but he was like very much just like, this is incredible. Like, he was so brilliant. And this is Malcolm Marshall's record versus Australia. He averages 22 versus England. He averages 19 versus India. He averages 22 versus New Zealand. He averages 21.5 and versus Pakistan. He averages 21. Again, this is not about them being hyped because of how good they were against England. These guys were good against absolutely everyone. Really important that we remember that. Abdullah says, again, weirdly, though, Australia produces a lot of frontline paces you can bat. Johnson, Stark, Lee, Rifle, Gillespie, Fleming. Yeah, I don't know if I'd have Fleming in that. But it is true, and it was something that we were kind of talking about a little bit on with Robbie the other day about someone asked a really interesting question about India tail compared to other countries' tails. There's no doubt that West Indies, Sri Lanka, and you can almost throw England in here at times. England produce all-rounders. They don't always produce bowlers who can bat. Sri Lanka very rarely seem to produce bowlers who can bat. The West Indies, again, Malcolm Marshall would be up there. How many other non-all-rounders do they have that were good with a bat? I'm trying to think of some. What would Ian Bishop have? Terrible with the bat. What would he have averaged? 14? 12? Right? So it's still on the lower end. Did I get that right? 12. Jeez, that is scary that I know these things. So I think the West Indies and Sri Lanka are the two interesting ones for me where they don't do that. I think with Australia, you certainly get... I think with Australia, it is interesting. Johnson's probably had the talent to be an all-rounder and didn't quite get there. Rifle was an all-rounder, really, certainly for Victoria. And when he got good at batting... So I think that's slightly different, right? But you're right when you look at guys like Stark and Lee and Gillespie and Cummins. Even someone like Craig McDermott would be another one. You go through, and I think Australia have had a lot of guys who can hold the bat or do something with the bat. I do think Australia plays a more total brand of cricket than other countries. I think there is more focus on tail enders being able to bat. Certainly when I was growing up, I remember that there was just no hiding. Like everyone had to learn how to bat and everyone had to learn how to field. Like it wasn't, you weren't considered, and with Australia, it's almost been a obsession, right? With, you know, especially in the 90s, that everyone had to take all facets of their game seriously. Whereas I know that other countries didn't do that. It just wasn't something that other countries did. So I do think it is a different outlook that Australia has, and that probably brings it along. But there also has to be a bit of us, right? Like, it just has to be, like, Bruce Reid couldn't bat at all. If Bruce Reid had played for a long time, and I'm trying to think of, if Bruce Reid, Mike Whitney, and Merv Hughes, so if Bruce Reid was fit, Mike Whitney was, you know, better, and Merv Hughes all played in a test match. That's a pretty long tail. And I think Lawson, Lily Tomo, Hogg, Lily Tomo, trying to think of some of the other eras. McGrath, obviously. So McGrath, Fleming, I'm trying to think of another bowler in the 90s. And McDermott's at 9. That could have been pretty weak as well. So, you know, some of it comes down to sort of dumb luck at a certain point, I think, as well. But I do think there is an element within Australia which is different than other places, which is Australia really embraced this sort of three-tool cricketer in a way that other countries did not. We know that in the 90s, Steve Waugh was obsessed with how his tail-enders would learn how to bat, right? In a way that other countries didn't seem as interested in as at the time. And I think that really had a bit lasting impact. Keshav says, did Gambia get a tougher coaching assignment compared to Dravid with an away tour to Australia, England, with an aging transitional team, while Dravid inherited the test team, at its peak, without going to Australia and England? Yes, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. Yeah, but Gambier was brought in as the transitional coach, right? Like, they were given different jobs. I think we all knew that going in. I wrote about the magic captaincy theory the other day, but magic coaching theory is the same thing. You can only coach what you have in front of you. Brendan McCullum has shown us that you can be more creative with that than you thought before. But at the end of the day, if Brendan McCullum had, I don't know, let's throw Trott, Strauss, Cape, and Pryor. No, it doesn't need Pryor. Trott, Strauss, I don't know, Hoggard or Sidebottom. This would be a much better side, right? Like, not even taking all time, and putting all time greats. And he might not have had to do all that other sort of stuff. The team would be better even if they weren't playing buzzball and they probably had those three players available to them, right? If they had Ducker and Strauss opening the batting with Trott at first drop and, you know, a Hoggard coming through, this would be a better team than before, right? And he wouldn't have used any of his magical coaching skills. So I think we always have to factor those things in when we get excited about all those things. Yash says, we all know a few players who S-tier but didn't perform well. Is there anyone who was not an S-tier talent-wise but somehow outperformed due to era, place, or other factors? Yeah, there have been plenty of players who overperformed. I mean, Paul Collingwood's basically a club cricketer, right? Who, you know, made a test double 100 in Australia. So there's been plenty of players like that. That's a fairly common thing. I would say Faf du Plessis is probably another one who I would say certainly in test cricket maybe overperformed, probably underperformed in the other formats that he ended up being good at. But yeah, no, I mean, that happens all the time. That's just, you know, sometimes you're the, you know, Tim Bresnan's record is ridiculous, right? And Tim Bresnan is not that level of player. But yeah, so you can have a period where you get very, very good and you get good results. You know, Adam Voges. So yeah, I think there are plenty of, that's a very common thing. Cricket is a professional. And so at certain periods, if things are going right, they will just cash in. Like, that's a fairly common theme of, you know, how professional sports work. And so you can have a player with, like, I think there's many issues with Vinod Kambli. Obviously, there's a whole caste thing. There's the partying thing. I had this fight with an Indian guy the other day where he was like, you don't understand what a bad influence he was. And I was like, no, I do. I just know there are lots of bad influences. And I said, you know, there are many factors why Vinod Kambli didn't end up. But if Vinod Kambli did play for a whole generation, he probably wouldn't have averaged what he averaged, right? Like, sometimes your numbers flatter you a little bit. Like, Dean Jones is probably another player who, as good as Dean Jones was, I think his batting average probably flattered him a little bit more. Bob Simpson is someone whose batting average is flattered. It's not that these aren't incredible players, because all three of those guys I just mentioned are really, really good. But you can get lucky. You can be a spinner who is from Asia and plays a bunch of tests in Asia, then gets injured and misses a bunch of tests away from home, doesn't get picked afterwards away from home because they don't think, so you end up with an incredible record. Like, these things happen quite a lot. Last super chat from Smeet says, South Africa's World Championship win shows equity works. England, black and Asian players have faced racism. Australia, two indigenous test players. India, four. Oh, it's funny that works on the last comment I was saying as well. Dalit test players, equity efforts in Australia, England, and India, token or real. Does dollars and wins excuse not doing much? Lessons from South Africa, should they adopt? South Africa is not really, it's still quite a one-dimensional cricket culture. You're still much likely, more like, I mean, it depends on how you look at equity. You're looking at it purely from a racial background. If you look at it from a class background, still think South Africa is one of the, I would say they're worse than the other three teams that you've just mentioned. You're very unlikely to play for England, to play for South Africa, if you have not gone to a private school when you are young or been recruited to a private school when you are young. You can do it in England, but generally it might happen a little bit later in England. So you might get picked up by the private school at 16, 17. Obviously, Australia is starting to have that issue, but hasn't had it all the way through. So, Samit, it really depends on where you're looking for equity. I don't think that this World Test Championship win, it shows how equity works, because I don't think that South African cricket is equitable, even close to being equitable. I don't want to go through all the different things you've talked about here. I think England probably are a weaker team now because they didn't embrace their black players in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it means that there aren't as many black people who play cricket anymore. So that has been, so not only were they racist, that actually caused a drop-off in their talent pool. You know, you only have to go through to the piece, was it the Wisden Cricketer wrote, which is one of the most racist pieces of all time. Obviously, the players involved sued M1. But Asian players as well. Asian players it's a combination of a couple of things within English and Asian players, which is really interesting. Some of it is that Asian players play and train and prepare and are available in a schedule that doesn't always suit with the professional lineup of how English cricket works. But that's also English cricket's fault for not making that work, right? And that's the thing that I've been very clear on, right? Like, I understand this. Australian Indigenous players probably goes back to what we were talking about with England black players, in that if Australia had picked Indigenous stars, you know, from Jack Marsh onwards, they would have had more Indigenous cricketers available to them later on, because more Indigenous kids would have played cricket and seen it as a pathway, right? So the fact that they didn't pick, you know, the one obvious player and maybe the two obvious players, and then, of course, you've got the whole thing with the guy in Western Australia as well years later. But the fact that they didn't pick any of them, right, means that they're way behind. And so Indigenous kids don't play as much cricket as they should, partly because it wasn't seen as their game. So again, if you know, and but you could make this claim with so many different parts of of it as well. One of the other big problems that Indigenous cricketers have is a lot of Indigenous people come from North Queensland and from Northern Territory. Those two places are generally underrepresented at the Australian level anyway, right? As someone was saying earlier and was bringing up, that so there's actually a big issue with the fact that it's not just about the Indigenous kids. It's about everyone from that area. If you're from Darwin and you're a good cricketer, you have to move out of Darwin, right, to play anywhere else. And have a look where Darwin is on a map. It's so far from the rest of Australia, right? And it's not a particularly rich place. So most of those kids, no matter what their backgrounds are. So there are, you know, and that goes back to the conversation me and Tim Wigmore had on the Red Inca as well. But yeah, and I think, and then India is the same. And I wouldn't just, it's funny that you've got India in. I think India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka have all had an issue at times of picking people from who are educated, who speak English, who are from the right kind of families, who went to the right kind of schools, whatever that may be. You know, like look at Sri Lanka, right? Like they basically pick batters from the same two or three schools over and over again, right? That's an issue, right? All of these things are issues that we have to get over. But South Africa has a lot of these issues as well, right? It's getting better. We're still a long way from it being there. But yeah, in truth, it doesn't matter what country you're talking about. There is always something to overcome. Let's go to the West Indies. The West Indies has had issues with picking Asian players at times, right? Because there was, Viv Richards was on the record of saying that he didn't want Asian players or wasn't as happy with Asian players at certain points during his career, right? There is huge problems between the black population and the Asian population at times. Forget that and move beyond that and say that has rectified itself at certain periods. What about the fact that they keep picking their team from four nations over and over again, right? Like, are we really saying that these other islands aren't producing individual players worthy of playing just because they're not from the major systems? So it's everywhere. If you want your team to be at its best, you have to be able to cast the net as wide as possible. And cricket has never done that for structural reasons, for geography reasons, for colonial reasons, for class reasons, for race reasons. All these different things have played a part in it, right? And South Africa is certainly not the poster child for getting it right. And I don't think, to be fair, even South Africa would pretend that. But they are making inroads into fixing that issue, right? Themba Bavuma and Kagiso Rabada and Mekhi Rantini, right, are really important cricketers to South African cricket in a way that AB de Villiers is not. But Hussey Cronje was a really important cricketer in South Africa. An Afrikaans captain. Before that, they were only picking English captains, right? Like it was a very English, South African English game. Then So there are lots of different people who are important for different things, getting it out to all these different areas, you know. But if you look at South African cricket, I can't remember what I did, what project it was for. It might have been for the Basil D'Oliveira one. If you look at the amount of cricketers that go to big schools, I think it was the Morkel brothers, Dale Steyn, and there might have been one other. I can't remember if it was Vernon or someone else, who had basically come out of the big school factories, right? And we know they're incredible. Like, you know, they really are. So if you really want to move this on, that's where you have to move it on. Eventually, more black people and non-white people will be involved in those schools anyway, right? But that would just be a natural thing because of the way that South African society is moving. But you don't just want, you know, Rabada's parents are like surgeons or something, right? Right? Like he still comes from a really, really privileged background. We want everyone in South Africa, all 50 million, 55 million, 60 million, whatever it is over there, to be able to have access to cricket. And that's not the case at the moment, right? You're much more likely to be a professional cricketer by a huge factor if you come from an elite school, right? It's not everything is just about skin tone. There are so many more parts to it, but that's why we have to have these sorts of conversations. That's why we have to keep moving it forward. It's a really, really important thing for our game. Thank you very much for the very generous super chat there, Sumit, as well. I was like, I'll take a couple of questions and I'll finish up quickly. I could have finished this with an hour and I went an extra 25 minutes. I hope you're all happy. What have we got coming up? We did a really good video on chases on that and had Alien, a really good article. Do that. Please If you follow our videos or our podcast, go over and sign up to us on Substack as well, because it really does help us. Anywhere that you can subscribe to Good Areas, even if you're not consuming that content all the time, is really important. Obviously, you know, the whole Patreon thing. Why can I never get my arrows right here? Patreon. Is that where I was? I did too. It's a really good way of supporting us. You've got all the different social medias over here. Can I not point properly? There we go. All the different social media things that you can support us on, you know, are really important. Going to goodareas.co, all that sort of stuff. And I would say this about everyone, you know, if there's a article that you like, if there's a podcast that you like, rate, review, subscribe, help these creators out, because it's a really confusing world out there for content creators at the moment. I get so many of them contacting me and being like, what do we do? It's not an easy thing. So yeah, I think is, you know, very, very, I think it is a very, very important one to have a look at that as well. Support your local creators is probably what I would say to that. That's me done, and we will be back again for more stuff. I don't even know when, but always.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.